Hi, everybody. Bob Claster here, and I'm the host of Funny Stuff, half an hour of comedy, which airs every Tuesday night here on KCRW at 7 o'clock. And this week and next week are two very special shows for me because I had a chance to have a nice long conversation with John Cleese in his hotel room, and that's what we'll be listening to this week and next. John Cleese, for those of you who don't know, and you certainly should know, it was one of the members of Monty Python's Flying Circus. He was the star and one of the co-writers of probably 12 of the funniest half hours ever broadcast anywhere in the world, entitled Fawlty Towers. And he is also the star of a very funny new movie called Clockwise, which I recommend you rush out and see at the conclusion of this program. We don't get around to talking about Clockwise this week. That's in next week's segment, but there's a lot of wonderful stuff to listen to this week and next week. The whole thing's wonderful. What can I tell you? The conversation started out with my telling Cleese that this following piece of material is the most requested piece that I've had to rebroadcast on this show, and it concerns Michelangelo and the Pope.
Evening, Your Grace. Evening, Michelangelo. I want to have a word with you about this Last Supper of yours.
Oh, yes?
I'm not happy with it.
Oh, dear. It took hours.
Not happy at all.
Do the jellies worry you?
No.
Oh, they add a bit of colour, don't they? Oh, I know, you don't like the kangaroo.
What kangaroo?
I'll alter it, no sweat.
I never saw a kangaroo.
Well, it's right at the back, but I'll paint it out, no problem. I'll make him into a disciple.
Ah.
All right now?
That's the problem.
What is it?
The disciples.
Are they too Jewish? I made Judas the most Jewish.
No, no, it's just that there are 28 of them.
Well, another one would hardly notice me. So I'll make the kangaroo into a disciple. All right. We'll lose the kangaroo altogether. I don't mind. I was never completely happy with it.
That's not the point. There are 28 disciples.
Too many?
Well, of course it's too many.
Well, in a way, but I wanted to give the impression of a huge get-together, you know. A real Last Supper. Not just any old supper, but a proper final treat. A real mother of a blowout.
There were only 12 disciples at the Last Supper.
Well, supposing some of the others happened to drop by.
There were only 12 disciples altogether.
Well, maybe they'd invited some friends.
There were the 12 disciples and our Lord at the Last Supper. The Bible clearly says so.
No friends?
No friends.
Waiters?
No.
Cabaret?
No.
You see, I like them. They fill out the canvas. I mean, I suppose we could lose 3 or 4 of them. You know, make 1 or 2 of them.
There were only 12 disciples.
I've got it. We'll call it the penultimate supper.
What?
There must have been one. I mean, if there was a last one, there must have been one before that, right?
Yes.
Right, so this is the penultimate supper. The Bible doesn't say how many people were there, does it?
No.
No, but there you are.
Look. The Last Supper is a significant event in the life of our Lord. The penultimate supper was not, even if they had a conjurer and a steel bat. Now, I commissioned a Last Supper from you, and a Last Supper I want.
Yeah, but look...
With 12 disciples and 1 Christ.
One?
Yes, one. Now, will you please tell me what in God's name possessed you to paint this with 3 Christs in it?
It works, mate!
It does not work!
It does! It looks great! The fat one balances the 2 skinny ones!
There was only 1 saviour!
Well, I know that. Everyone knows that. But what about a bit of artistic license?
1 redeemer!
I'll tell you what you want, mate! You want a bloody photographer! Not a creative artist with some imagination!
I tell you what I want! I want a Last Supper with 1 Christ, 12 disciples, no kangaroos by Thursday lunch, or you don't get paid!
Bloody fascist!
Look, I'm the bloody Pope! I may not know much about art, but I know what I like!
love that piece. Because there's some wicked lines in it, you know? I like when Michelangelo says the Pope, he says, did I make the disciples too Jewish? And then immediately he says, I made Judas the most Jewish. Terrible, funny.
What was that written for?
A few years ago, when I was still married to Connie Booth, she complained one day that she wasn't getting anything interesting to do. So I said, all right, I said, just for fun, I will write a radio show. And I wrote a radio show, and a full half hour. And she wrote one or two other bits of material with me, and they fixed the recording date. And then she came to me and she said, I've just been offered a very big part in a television show. And I said, take it. So we had to go ahead and record the radio show, and I got some friends in, and this sketch, the Michelangelo Pope sketch, was written for the radio show, except I wasn't allowed to record it. BBC Radio banned the sketch. They said it was blasphemy. So it has subsequently been performed in the theatre for the Secret Policeman's Ball.
That's the recording that I have.
Exactly. It's been out on television, it's been out on record, and it's on videotape, but BBC Radio still won't play it because they still think it's blasphemous, which is the sort of really stuffy, boring side of the BBC, which you come across sometimes.
Let's start pretty much at the beginning. There's a wonderful story in a book called From Fringe to Flying Circus.
Very good book. I mean, for anybody's interested in English comedy, all three of you out there, it's a remarkably
oh, there's more than three
accurate
of them I hear
book,
from.
Really? And I'll tell you why it's accurate, because it is not written by a British journalist. This is the main reason for stories not being accurate, is that they're written by British journalists. It's written by a guy called Roger Wilmot, who actually is an editor with the BBC, and he writes these things kind of in his spare time. I really recommend that book if anybody's curious about
it. I don't think it's
English.
Available in this country. I picked
really?
It up when I was over there.
Because it's great. It starts, as you say, with Beyond the Fringe, and it just works the whole way through, right the way through the Pythons. And,
well, it's a wonderful story all the way through. To skip ahead a bit, it's sort of amazing that it seems that the confluence of talent that was at Cambridge from the late 50s through the middle 60s, it's just astonishing. Is that just because anyone that's clever and English just gravitated to that school?
I don't think so. I think it's one of those very strange coincidences that sometimes at a particular place, at a particular time, a lot of talent suddenly erupts. And the fact that one or two people are very good nurtures the next generation and a half. And it's like Australian tennis until about 10, 12 years ago. There's no reason why such a small nation should have dominated world tennis the way they did. But it was just that once you have a few people who are really good, there's something for the younger people to shoot at. And then eventually those traditions just die away. You know what I mean? And even if you're talking about something important like the Renaissance, most of that sort of gone 100 years after its peak.
Has that died away, or does it continue to this day? Are there still wonderful Footlights reviews going on there now?
It kind of died away by the mid-60s, and then some other good people started coming through much later without any particular reference to the earlier people. But I must say, from about the time of Jonathan Miller in 54, followed by Peter Cook in 58, and then a lot of people round about my generation, and beginning to taper off with Eric Idle about 64 or 65, and Graham Garden, a remarkable number of people, and nothing like so many at Oxford, only two or three really, two of whom were obviously Dudley Moore and Alan Bennett, Beyond the Fringe.
And Terry Jones was at Oxford, wasn't
he? Terry Jones, yes. When I say that, I'm excluding Michael Palin and Terry Jones of Monty Python because I don't personally think they're very good, but others do.
Well, there are many of us that do. So there's a wonderful story about your first contact with the Footlights Club at Cambridge.
Oh, yes, that's right, yes. I went up to the stall that said Footlights at a great big society's fair. That is its name, which you get in the first two or three days of each Cambridge year, when every society there, from the potholders through the astronomers through the parapsychological association right the way through to the rugby club and the madrigal singers, all set up stalls and try and get as many people as possible to pay subscriptions for the year. And I went up to the Footlights stall and said I was kind of interested because people had told me that I ought to do it. Because I'd done house entertainments at school, and people said, you should join the Footlights. And they said, oh, good, they said, can you sing? Well, I was thrown out of singing classes when I was 11, partly for subversive activities, but mainly for lack of talent. So I said, no. I was amazed by this question. They said, can you dance? The idea of me dancing, one of the sort of five least coordinated men in Europe. Just hysterical. So I went pale by this time. Then they said, oh, well, what do? They said. And I, blushing, I blurted out. I said, I try to make people laugh. And that sort of went bright red and kind of ran off in confusion. And never went near them again for about 6 months. Until my closest friend at Cambridge, who's still to this day my closest friend, came up to me and said, I just bumped into an old school friend who's invited me to go and do something at the Footlights. Do you want to help me? And we wrote something together, and I got voted into the club. And 2 days later, after being voted in, I was there and watching people like David Frost up there performing. He's actually the only well-known one that you would know in America. Mm-hmm. And then by the time we came back at the beginning of the next year, all these great figures had left, and we all found we were on the committee and running this organization. So people like Tim Brooke Taylor and Bill Oddie and myself were catapulted forward. And that year I did a review that was directed by Trevor Nunn, who of course now runs the Royal Shakespeare Company, or has done for 18 years.
I love the
years.
Story of the scenery from that.
What was that?
According to Wilmot's book, he says that Trevor Nunn was putting on a production of Shakespeare, and he wanted to build a very expensive set, but there wasn't the budget for it, but there was the budget for the Footlights. So he built this set for use in the Footlights, this wrought iron thing, which was apparently very clumsy and made no sense in the context of the Footlights.
That's absolutely right. Why did he build it?
Well, he wanted to use it for Shakespeare.
Ah, I didn't know that. That's very funny. I should have read all the books, shouldn't I? The little bastard. He's not short of money now, having produced Starlight Express, Cats, and two others in the last
Nicholas
4 years.
Nicholas Nickleby,
didn't
he do
Nicholas Nickleby? Nickleby, yes.
Yes, that was wonderful.
Very nice man, too, and extremely disarming and easy to work with. Charming guy. So I was good, you know, it was nice to start, have Trevor Nunn as my first director.
Well, now, what you told them was that you try to make people laugh.
Yeah.
Have you given much thought to what it is about you that makes people laugh, what it is that makes you funny? There's something about you that transcends the material that you're doing. You're often much funnier than the specific lines in the business that you're doing. Do you have any idea what that is?
No.
Or just don't you worry about it?
Well, I don't agree with you, you see. I mean, I think that the fact that I've been pretty successful and don't have too many really terrible shows and have a reasonable number of good ones around is that I've always thought that I was as good as the material and no better. And I once wrote for Peter Sellers, and I saw how that poor man was preyed upon by film producers who'd say, oh, don't worry about the script, Peter. You're so funny. You'd be funny without the script. The moment that you start believing you could be funny in a situation that isn't any good... I really believe that. I disagree with you. There are two or three people in my experience who were funny... No matter what the material was, there was an English vaudeville comic called Tommy Cooper who could just stand there and make me laugh. But I can't do that. I have to have a situation that's funny. I have to have a funny idea that I'm coming from. That's what I believe. And I don't think that I'm any funnier than the material that I've got.
Well, I saw Harvey Korman playing Basil Fawlty, and it was the same material. But it wasn't as funny.
It was only a bit the same material. They tried to take the best 6 situations from 4 shows or something like that and put them all into one show. So the thing was a mess to begin with. Also, Harvey Korman had trouble playing Basil because this American need on a lot of your television to reassure people that nobody really being nasty to anybody else, you know. Now, the great thing is it doesn't matter how nasty people are to each other. You can still like these villains. People in Britain love Basil. Mm-hmm. People love W.C. Fields. I mean, W.C. Fields is only about 2 points worse than Hitler. I mean, he's a terrible man, yeah. You know? He's just foul to everyone. He's totally paranoid. He doesn't like women. He doesn't like children. He doesn't like animals. He doesn't like anybody who sells insurance. He doesn't like lawyers. And about now, he starts joining the general population in his dislikes. But he hated everybody, and everybody still loves him because he's funny. So Harvey Korman had to kind of do jokes and Betty White, and then after doing a nasty, hard-edged line like Basil or Sybil do to each other, they'd have to do something to say, it's okay, folks, we're only kidding, you know.
Well, I also felt they felt they had the need to explain each joke by doing
a
it twice.
A little bit, yes, that's right. It was a feeling they didn't trust the material, that somehow the American audience was dumber than the British audience and had to have it fed to them more slowly. And that, of course, is rubbish.
But surely you don't believe that you could take any 6'6" person with a mustache, put him in that situation, teach him the lines. And
No. I mean, I'm a very good technical performer, and I'm also very good at judging how things should be done, because I rely entirely on intuition, and my intuition is now good, because I reckon intuition is kind of a subconsciously programmed experience, if you see what I mean. Mm-hmm. But I would have said, if they were playing it in America, I would have said, give this to Peter Boyle, and he would have made it terribly funny. He would have been superb.
Did you see the series that he just did?
No.
It was wonderful. It's called Joe Bash.
Ah, I have to see this.
If you can get a hold of it.
Great. Well, if any of your listeners... they're in contact with Peter Boyle. No, I hope they'll send him my love, because I knew him and I've lost his address in New York. And he's just... I thought he was marvellous. I think he's a great performer. And I go, well, I can reminisce about Peter. I think he's a wonderful... Had he done the American version of Fawlty Towers and done it with someone who didn't try and explain the jokes to the mm-hmm. audience or soften it or reassure them they weren't really being nasty, it would have worked fine. But there weren't too many people who could have done it. No, but there were a few. There were a mm-hmm. couple in England. There was a Richard Briers could probably have done it. Lena Rossiter certainly could have done it. But, I mean, don't think I'm being modest, because those scripts were brilliant.
Oh, absolutely.
But it was the brilliance, as far as I'm concerned, was in the scripts that Connie and I wrote, and much more than in the performance. Performance was highly... highly competent, better than that, actually. Somebody Manuel, you know, Andrew Sachs, actually, he had a little more space to create that character and to let it get a little bigger. And, of course, it couldn't actually have been done any better.
Well, it was a wonderful show. When we were in London for our honeymoon, we saw, we just went past it, but there's a restaurant called Fawlty Towers.
Yes, that's
right. With a sign in the window that says something like, you know, see Basil abuse the customers and see Polly do this and see Manuel do this. Have you been there?
No, I haven't. I've only been told about it, and I haven't been avoiding it, but I've never actually seen it. But there are at least 6 establishments in the UK and several outside, like Australia, New Zealand, probably Canada, I don't remember, where people have called their restaurant or hotel 40 times.
As if anyone would really want to go to
it. Well, I think it immediately becomes an object of curiosity. There was a guy in Scotland who opened a restaurant and not only called it 40 Towers, he had a 6-foot plywood cutout of me outside, sort of pointing, gesturing. The funny thing is, in law, you can't do anything to stop them, nor can you ask them in any way to check what they're doing or to ask mm-hmm. you to okay it or to have any control over it at all, which is quite strange to find. You can do absolutely nothing that somebody can have a cardboard or plywood cutout of you outside their restaurant, and they're entitled to do that. Mm-hmm. Even, you know what I mean, not as a comedy show or something, but to make the money from business.
Well, you're a public figure.
That's right. And I was quite surprised about that, but I was delighted that this plywood cutout was stolen 2 days later. That gave me a good laugh. But nobody ever writes and says, can we do it, or anything. It's really quite strange.
So you haven't been curious enough to go down there and see what it is?
No, I will one day when I get some time on my hand. But once I go in, you know what I mean, people will sit me down.
They're going to
3 hours telling me what their favorite bits are, you know.
You're just going to be very abusive, is probably what I would do.
And then you already see that, so he's just like that, Basil. You see, in real life, he's just like which is all anybody wants to know. Everybody always says, you know.
But that was based on an actual place in Turkey, right?
Yes, very good. It was based on a place that we stayed where Monty Python was shooting in Turkey in 71 or 72. And this astoundingly rude man ran it, who was just like Basil, except he was very small and his wife was very big. Now, the advantage of having me and Prue playing it is that it's not so obvious that it's the henpecked husband, which is actually the kind of stereotype, the mm-hmm. archetype under it. Because I'm big and Prue is small, people don't immediately see that. But the original guy, whose name was Sinclair, was astoundingly rude, because when Terry Gilliam was sitting at dinner one night, cutting the meat as the Americans do, you know, cutting the meat and then putting the knife on the top of the plate, moving the fork to the right hand, spearing the meat that has been cut. And this man he stopped as he was going by, and he stared at Terry about 5 seconds, if not 10, and he said, we don't eat like that in this country. Absolutely astounding.
Well, does he know that he is?
Yes, because I deliberately hid the man's name from people for a number of years, but one day I told somebody that it was a guy called Sinclair who'd been at Glen Eagles Hotel, and the next thing I knew, this information had got into one of the English daily papers, the Daily Mail, And they tracked the poor so-and-so down in Miami, I think it was. And they actually sat his daughter down with the tapes and played the tapes. And she said, oh, yes, she said, that's just like Mum and Dad. Just a final nail in the coffin for the poor thing. But I must say he was so rude that he doesn't particularly deserve anybody not to base a comedy character.
Well, it was actually started as an episode for another series.
Correct? Ah, you are right, yes, because I was writing a series for ITV for a great friend of mine, yes, called Humphrey Barclay, who directed the 63 Footlights Review, and then he went into television, radio first, then television. And he came to me once and asked me to write some for a series called Doctor in the House. I don't think you ever got them, did you?
No.
They were quite good. They were just about a young guy training as a doctor and all the things that happened to him based on a series of books by Richard Gordon. They were pretty good. And I lost some money. I put a lot of money into a health club and it collapsed. It was just before they became really fashionable. Mm-hmm. And I was just ahead of my time. And I needed some money and I wrote 6 half-hours. And one of them I set in a restaurant and hotel. Like, just, you know, I didn't call it 40 Towers because I obviously didn't have the name, but it was exactly like that, with the Basil character being played by a very good actor called Timothy Bates, and who was actually small, like the original of Basil, this guy Sinclair. And at the end of the show, which had gone pretty well, old Humphrey Barclay said to me, he said, do you know, he said, there's a series in that character. I remember thinking, bloody television producers, all they can think about is series. And then about 3 years later, when I had always wanted to write something with Connie and work with her, we sat down and said, what are we going to do? And within an hour, we knew that it was going to be this situation comedy set at this hotel. It was extraordinary how quickly we made up our mind what it was all about.
Now, you were in a situation where you could have hired a writing staff and sat back and played Basil Fawlty into your old age. Was that a temptation for you at all?
No, not at all, because, first of all, I'm reasonably well off now because I've got a number of things going, earning money for me, principally a training films company called Video Arts that we started 15 years ago, which is, I think, now the biggest training film company in the world outside the US of A. So that kind of keeps me ticking along. So I didn't need the money. And mm-hmm. there would be absolutely no point, as far as I was concerned, going on and on doing it, because I don't get that much satisfaction out of acting. It's pretty minimal, the satisfaction I get out of acting. See, the only thing I like doing is writing, but that's terribly hard work. Mm-hmm. And I only like to do it in short bursts. I think the trouble with most writers is they write too much. I often see things up there on the screen, or even read books, and I think, why was this written, you know? And then I suddenly realized one day that things were written like that because the guy was a writer. And yeah, so he had to write. And he wrote this, and it wasn't very good. But this is how he earns his bread, so he had to sell it anyway. And that, a lot of stuff, I feel, just shouldn't really be there, because every writer only has so much good material in him in 1 year. And if he can possibly arrange things for the best possible result, then he should only write, you know, that amount of stuff. But most people spread that amount of good material in something that's 3 times as big or 3 times as long, so it's much more patchy and mm-hmm. spread too thinly. So my great advantage has always been that when I came to do 40 Towers, I gave Connie and myself 36 weeks to write the 6 episodes, and we took 36 weeks, and we never felt too pressured by time. And in those 36 weeks, we were able to build a lot of ideas, reasonably original ideas, and fasten them together in a reasonably satisfactory structure. You know,
well, it's wonderful
else
that you could do that. I know I have friends that write to American television, and if you can't write an episode of situation comedy in 2 weeks, they say you're in the wrong business.
Well, and exactly. And what the trouble is, the people who say that are in the wrong business, because they're the ones who are responsible for the rotten television. Mm-hmm. Because they think it has to be written. If they were all fired, and people who were put in who said, take 5 weeks to write something, and we'll pay you 2.5 times as much money, but it'll have to be 2.5 times better, then you'd start getting television that would be really exciting, and the viewing figures would go up. They'd make more on advertising, you know. But they
won't
think
like
that.
What? When do we take over?
Well, the trouble is that folks like us don't want to do that because we don't want to be executives. So they put some of these cloth-eared idiots who don't know a good script from a bite in the arse, And they're supposed to make these decisions, and they're totally unqualified to do so. They go around parroting each other's phrases, like, if you can't write a comedy in 2 weeks, you oughtn't to be in this business. And they're the ones who oughtn't to be in it.
Yeah.
Sorry, but I felt it was time I got a little excited and said something interesting and controversial.
We'll mark it down. You're
yeah?
duly
That's
noted.
My controversial speech.
Speaking
also, I'm in favor of war. I want to make a really controversial pro-war film in which I come out strongly in favor of young men blowing each other's limbs off.
Well, doesn't that contradict Privates on Parade? You'll then have to retract that one.
Absolutely. No, I want to do something really controversial. I decided that a pro-war movie was the way to do it, something to stir people up.
Well, there are so many of them, though. I mean, what is Rambo in
a
pro-war movie?
You mean. Yes, maybe that's true. That hadn't actually struck me, but I suppose Rambo is a pro-war movie. It's certainly pro, we are the good people and entitled to kill everyone else who disagrees with this movie. What an extraordinary bit of film that is. I mean, if that isn't playing on an audience's basest instincts, what is? You know, let's all get together and kill everyone who isn't like us. Having set them up, first of all, as being frightfully evil and getting too...
But not only that, but let's do it half-naked.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. I would love to do an English Rambo in which somebody, a very nice,
for
rather
tea and things like
restrained
that.
English accountant who's been ticked off by his wife being late for tea, goes to the cinema in a huff and sees Rambo and becomes so enraged by the sheer mindlessness of it, by the sheer adulation of violence and by the ludicrousness of the idea that problems can be solved by blowing everybody who disagrees with you to pieces, decides that he is going to kill Sylvester Stallone, strips himself to the waist, spends 4 months practicing with a sort of sharpened umbrella point, and sets off towards Hollywood, slaying large quantities of Americans, especially cops, and presumably, since those things are always populists, large numbers of American civil servants based in Washington on the way. Oh, dear. I suddenly felt very tired.
Well, that's all we have time for this week, but next week we'll be listening to the rest of my conversation with John Cleese, and in next week's installment we'll be listening to, we'll be talking about things like Monty Python, his feelings about the religious furor that was caused by the movie The Life of Brian, and we'll be talking about his new movie Clockwise, which is, by the way, very funny, is playing around town, and is well worth seeing. You know, it's such a pleasure when you meet somebody whose work you've always admired and you find out that you like them as much as you hoped you would. And I hope you have enjoyed this meeting with John Cleese and that you will enjoy next week's meeting as much as I enjoyed meeting the meeting. At any rate, let's see, what else is there to tell you about? The address is Bob Claster, C-L-A-S-T-E-R. Funny Stuff, KCRW, 1900 Pico Boulevard, Santa Monica, California, 90405. If you include a phone number, you stand a very good chance of hearing from me. And what else? Special thanks to Sally Bartel for making this show and the next week's show possible. And that's about it. So until next week, this is your host, Bob Claster, thanking you for listening and reminding you to always keep that sense of humor well exercised, because you never know when you're going to need it. Have a great week, everybody. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.